thank you so much for the book and the TV. I've just seen the first a sort of finalish cut of the TV show. It's so good. Just thank you so much for doing that. It's a really lovely thing.
So we should explain to people listening that you put together a book called Dear NHS. Why don't you tell me about that?
Oh, we started.
Yeah, I go in for a soft start. This is the Dear NHS book, which I just received a copy of. I haven't read yet, but I got my copy of it. And so you just thought, I will ask, is it 50 or 100 people you ask?
I mean, on the front cover, it says 100. If you were to actually count the names, it would be 109. But we
bonus.
It's a bonus, or it's mis-selling, whatever it is.
It's a fine line.
You know what it's like. You have to tell, like, all the bookshops what the book is called. And we thought we'll call it Dear NHS, 100 Stories to Say Thank You. And we overshot.
Presumably that's because you have to over-ask the number of people, because some of them, often people like me, don't meet deadlines and don't know how to meet deadlines.
I mean, some of the people, including you, are quite busy and famous and important enough that you can quite reasonably say, no, I get asked for 3,000 things a day, I'm really sorry. Unfortunately/fortunately, everyone said yes. I mean, we put together the list as a sort of like dream team, and everyone just said yes. Paul McCartney said yes. Oh. Joanna Lumley said yes. Ed Sheeran said yes. All the people who were meant to say, I'm really sorry, I'm Ed Sheeran, were actually, I'd love to do this. I owe a lot to the NHS, and here you go. So the fact there's too many people was a rather nice thing.
Yes, it's an embarrassment of riches in the truest sense. It's like, but presumably there must have been some people who said no. Come on, there must have been.
Yeah, there were a couple of people who said no, but it was people who... There was no one who said no who was just like, ugh, I hate the NHS, I'm not doing this. It was more, I'm in the middle of doing this extremely big thing and I'm extremely famous. There was no one who blanked us. No one, either me or the publisher asked, and they were just like, nothing. Everyone either said yes or had a really good reason. Apart from one person, actually, and I'll tell you that person after we've stopped recording.
Ooh, tantalising for me and really irritating for anybody listening. When I was thinking about what I was going to write, obviously I've got a lot of stories about the NHS. One of my first memories was being in hospital when I was 4 and children's ward in the eye unit. And they were just so magnificent then. And I thought, well, I could tell lots of stories about my dad because the NHS saved my dad's life about 40 times before it got to the stage that they couldn't anymore. And then I thought, no, I probably should write something a bit more fun. So for those who haven't read the book, how should we euphemistically describe the chapter that I wrote? It's about
an insertion.
It's about somebody, me in this case, falling onto an attachment of a cleaning device. Because I know that you... From reading your book, you know, you used to get multiple people coming in with making ludicrous excuses that they'd had things shoved up their arse or whatever.
Every single day. It was the thumping baseline of working as a doctor.
So I want to get onto that, but I need to confess something really. So I hand in this chapter, as you know, and it's all about, you know, me falling on a Hoover attachment from a great height. And the BBC had very kindly agreed to make a companion documentary to this book, which was filmed remotely. And there was a lovely, gorgeous guy in Scotland asking me questions, and I was being filmed. And about halfway through relaying this incident, it became clear to me that having read my chapter, he believed it to be true. So I'm now in a state of sort of panic that people watching that documentary will think, God, she's really trying hard to excuse what was essentially her shoving a Hoover up her ass. Did you get that sense when you watched the early rushes of the documentary?
I'm happy to be able to inform you that the BBC censors decided they would much rather major on eye surgery and multiple visits to A&E with accidents not involving a Dyson.
Or any other Hoover.
Other Hoovers are available.
Yes, and in some ways, in current climate, preferable. So it was a nod to the chapter in your book, essentially. So you say it was the baseline. How many times a week would you get an unfortunate insertion?
I worked in Obs and Gynae, Brats and Twats, as it was known, on the, And I would only be called to A&E if it was something that was beyond A&E's normally excellent capabilities. So I got extreme insertion.
I was going to say, that's deep insertion, isn't it?
Yeah, or an insertion that has caused a cut, or indeed multiple burns from the patient who shoved up a chain of fairy lights one Christmas.
It's festive. I mean, no one. Festive. Could, I mean, why not be festive internally as
brings
well?
Brings new meaning to the phrase. I put the Christmas lights up myself. And so all... yeah. So I mean, yeah. There were a few. In fact, there were enough for a book.
that's all you need, really. Just enough for a book. I did hear of one guy who'd wanted. I don't know why he wanted it, but he decided that he wanted a paperweight in the shape of the inside of his rectum. So he decided to do a concrete cast.
Oh, no.
Did not turn out well.
No.
I mean, even I, not being a builder, know that one of the prime ingredients of concrete is extremely burny.
Oh, dear. Well, that's extraordinary. Couldn't you just do a poo and cast that?
Oh, a firm poo. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, just sort of... not too much fibre for a few days, hold off the water, see how that goes. Anyone listening, I recommend that, because then the concrete needs to go nowhere near your rectal mucosa.
No.
But these, I mean, when I, like, if I'm going on stage and sort of doing, like, you know, you do these book tours and Q&A sort of stuff, sometimes people say, you know, they'll point to one of these stories of a thing in a place and say, surely that didn't happen. But doctors who attend these events never say that. They say, that's nothing. Here's my top five amazing objects in places.
My mate, who's a doctor, spent her first day, she wants to specialise in sexual health. First day, sat down, guy comes in, but she barely gets a chance to say anything to him by way of a hello or a greeting. He drops his trousers millimetres from her face and says, I have a fire in my fuck stick. Welcome to medicine.
Wow. Yeah. Was that English as a first language? Because I know that is a phrase that Duolingo do have.
Yes, it was. I don't believe that it was necessarily his first. As you say,
no, because I'm sure that I've had to translate that into Spanish for the owl.
It does sound curious, a sort of Babelfish sort of end product, doesn't it?
Tengo fuego en fuck stick. Oh. Edit to make it me sound like I'm doing better with my Duolingo than I am.
I know you don't practice any longer, but how long do you get to keep your doctorary license for? Are you still recognised?
I mean, I don't use the term to describe myself, except if I'm trying to get an upgrade in a restaurant or an aeroplane, which never works. I guess I've still got the degree, but to be honest, even when I was working as a doctor, I'd never say to my patients, "My name's Dr. K. I'm here to." It's, you know, my bedside manner was always a lot more Adam.
Was there any point where you did want to do that? Or did it feel like something that was part of the sort of family lineage and you had to just adhere to?
To do medicine in the first place?
Yeah.
I think about this a lot, and I've been thinking about it even more recently, because a lot of people have been questioning how they got into medicine, because they're now doing things that they probably never signed up for. Like, putting your life on the line is not something that you ever expect to do, having to move away from your family for, you know, 3 months in case you come back and infect someone vulnerable, you know, going to work in woefully inadequate protective equipment. This is, you know, that is not what they signed up for. And I don't quite know why I did medicine. But in fairness, I was 18 when I applied, and I was 16 when I chose my A-levels that I needed to have for medical school. Is it fair to expect a teenager to know what they're getting into? Because I don't think I knew what I was getting into. And, you know, I was all right at science, lots of doctors in my family. It was a sort of default setting if I didn't come up with a better idea, and I didn't. And, you know, and on the other side, it's the most wonderful profession. It's such a privilege to do, and we all know that. But I'm not sure. I mean, when you've been to hospital, if you need an operation, you've filled out a consent form, informed consent. So they don't just say the benefits, we are doing X. They also say the risks. There is a risk that there might be bleeding or infection or having this anesthetic or a blood clot or damaging something we didn't mean to. That's informed consent. I'm not convinced that I or medical students, prospective medical students going into the profession, are informed.
No. And I think it becomes, or must be, harder to leave. I mean, for example, for me, I know I go off and do a nice English literature degree. There's no expectation on me to do anything. In fact, quite the opposite with that kind of qualification. But my medic friends, you know, once they're in that system, the amount of time and money that's being invested in them and they're investing in themselves creates in itself a kind of unwarranted momentum. And then you're suddenly 7 years into studying. And it feels for them, I think, at that point, almost foolhardy to stop. It's like, well, we've gone this far.
There's that. There's the fact it's very much a vocation. There's also the fact that for various peculiar reasons, the job becomes your defining characteristic. It's a job where you miss a lot of Christmases and birthday parties, and you miss a lot of weddings, and your social circle contracts, and then your job will say, oh, you've got to move 60 miles away. So you move 60 miles away. And suddenly the paraphernalia around your life of relationships and friendships and social life start to fall away a bit, and you're left with your job. And your job is such a top trump. When you're working on labour ward, and you're meant to be going off for drinks at 7 o'clock because it's someone's birthday and someone starts bleeding out and there's no one to take over from you because it's a system that doesn't have that slack. So you stay and you sort them out, and suddenly it's 9 o'clock and you've missed the thing. You are pleased with your decision because that was the right decision. It isn't that you were just fanning around in the office with your spreadsheets because you might as well do it now. It's life and death. And there's a culture in medicine where you don't leave. I did leave.
Yeah.
And when I left, I was the first or second person in my cohort of about 300 people at medical school in my year who left. These days, there's a big crisis in retention of doctors. Mm. It's a very different picture. But at the time, it's you don't do that. You know, you're a bloody doctor and you bloody get on with it.
Yes, because there's this idea that if it is a vocation, then the vocation is unwavering. And it can't have possibly been a vocation that only lasted 10 years, which, of course, is ridiculous. Mm. You can have different drives and motivators and passions in the course of a life.
You can. And I think I was slightly missold into the job because I wasn't aware how bad the bad days got. There was not a single lesson at medical school called how to cope. There wasn't a single bit. And these things are changing a bit now, which is amazing. But historically, medicine hasn't been very good at looking after the well-being of their staff. And I think as a country, we're getting better about being open about mental health. And I think that's a brilliant thing. You know, I would like to think that, you know, I or my friends, you know, are happy to talk to each other and talk openly about seeking help from counsellors or starting on antidepressants and stuff like that. Medicine's 10, 20 years behind that. There's still a stigma about opening up, about talking about this sort of thing. I still get messages from doctors who've read This Is Gonna Hurt, my first book, saying, I thought I was the first person who'd ever cried in the toilet, because the culture makes you think that everyone else is just coping. And if you're to have something stupid like emotions, then you're in some way a failure. And so you don't talk about it, and bottling stuff up is never the right answer.
I've always found that strange, that medicine is, at its heart, the definition of a caring profession. But its practitioners are trained in not expressing that care or emotion in an externalised way so that one might see it. And I understand, of course, you have to be professional and you can't just burst into tears if your favourite patient suddenly gets a terminal diagnosis. But
there's a... It there isn't is a binary. Yes, exactly.
Exactly that. And there is... You know, I always remember when my... the most affecting thing that happened in all the horror of my dad's sort of slow dwindling was that after he passed away, his consultant wrote us a letter. And it was so... I don't even have the word for it. It was painful and affecting and glorious, and it made me laugh and cry. But what the thing that got me was that he got my dad. This was somebody who just understood him like a friend, valued him, and said he would miss him. And I just, and that he said there are a few patients that stick with you, and your dad accepted the relentless horror of what was handed to him with a kind of old school grace that simple act of kindness from a virtual stranger, he wasn't my consultant, I didn't have much to him, has changed the whole way I am able to deal with the process of grieving. That's powerful.
Yeah, that's lovely. What a good doctor. That's what makes a good doctor.
He is a great doctor. I think
compassion and communication is what the job's about. And I think that's how we should be recruiting our doctors, rather than loads of A's at A level. And are you good at the cello? Or do you play lacrosse, which is the current system used? Let's drop the grades. I've always thought we should drop the grades so you don't just end up with people from public schools who've been trained how to get A's in their A levels.
Yeah.
So you get a wider breadth of society. Get rid of requirements that you have to have loads of work experience working in hospitals and GP surgeries, because once again, that excludes a lot of people whose mum's best mate isn't the consultant orthopaedic surgeon. Mm-hmm. And just, I don't know, just get the people who will turn into the consultant who will write that letter, because for me, that's what a good doctor is, not someone who can memorize a biochemical pathway.
I totally agree, though, that the idea that it's to be the criteria to be a good doctor would be lots of A's at A level and one side hobby that you also have to excel at, whether it's cello or whether it's true. And but also this division that, you know, you say that you became a doctor because you couldn't think of anything else. The what is happening more and more, that, you know, children are being forced to choose, make these binary choices between arts and sciences quite early on, with a heavy government preference towards STEM. And there should be a sort of more of a national curriculum where right up to the end, you're still learning about social anthropology or political sciences or even home economics, you know, or how to manage your money on some level. You know, we're not providing.
That's a huge thing.
Huge. No one teaches us that shit, and then we all fail at it.
Yeah.
And no one's had pensions.
Yeah. You know, if I put my hand on my heart, I don't think I could tell you what an interest rate is. I hear that they go up and down, and I know that it changes my mortgage. But I don't know that. I don't really understand inflation. It was never taught. And I didn't know about how to get a current account or, you know, a checkbook in those days. Right? This is important. You know, that's important. But I think GCSEs were more fun for me than A-levels because of the breadth of stuff I was learning. And I'm not no educational expert, obviously, it goes without saying, but I would have loved, whilst I was doing the sciences that the medical schools wanted, also to continue with writing, which was obviously something that I enjoyed and had some aptitude for. But you couldn't, if you were going down the medical school route at the time, you couldn't also continue with your English. So that sort of evaporated a bit.
It's almost like we need sort of modules. So you can do predominantly science modules, but then you could also do drama or creative writing or art history.
And I think you'd have happier students.
I totally
agree. Who want
to
go to school. Why don't we make you head of education?
Because I'd be terrible. Oh. I barely get around to answering an email. And as you know, I'm not great with deadlines. You have personal experience of this. And I do believe that the head of education has to have those very basic skills.
It's a big blow.
I mean, you know, you talk about sort of crying in the loos, and was there one sort of moment where you thought enough, or was it just that drip feed of painful, exhausting, moments?
So that's a good question. I thought there was one moment. A lot of, I've been stupid enough to read reviews of my book, and I know you're not meant to do that, but a lot of people, when they read the book, said we knew something bad was coming. We saw that from the, because it was written as my diaries at the time, something I hadn't spotted myself, but I'd
Yes.
clearly been writing down, was this death by a thousand cuts, where I was changing and it was all going wrong. But I had my coping mechanism. No one taught me a coping mechanism. They didn't teach me to talk to people. They didn't teach me to take time out. They didn't teach me to, to meditate or whatever it is that would have helped. So my coping mechanism was writing stuff down, looking for the light amongst the dark. I didn't know it was my coping mechanism. I didn't know why I thought I was doing it, but in retrospect, that's what I was doing. It was a decent enough mechanism. It gave me a certain thickness of armor, but there were certain assaults that would pierce that relatively thin armor, even though it got thicker with the years. And for me, I was working on a labor ward. I was the most senior doctor on that labor ward. So I wasn't a consultant. I was a sort of one step down from that, a senior registrar, which meant I would be the most senior person on out of hours. And it was a weekend. All you ever want on labor ward is a healthy mum plus a healthy baby. And this was one of the awful, tragic moments where we ended up with neither, and the buck sort of stopped with me. And I've stopped saying that it was my fault because it wasn't, because it was just an awful tragedy that couldn't have been prevented, really. And everyone was saying that I did the right stuff at the right time, but it was me who was there. And I didn't talk about it because, like we say, doctors don't, but people knew what had happened. And they would remind me that if you're the most senior doctor on the labour ward, you will have some kind of big tragedy every 5 or 6 years. And it's not about how good you are, or how hard you work, or the number of qualifications you get. It's just the horrible fact of it that not everything is preventable. It's not about how good you are. It's the nature of the profession. But hearing that made me feel worse. It made me realize that I couldn't face that kind of thing ever happening to me ever again, let alone twice a decade. And so I ended up leaving the profession. And so it was one big thing. And I wasn't offered help. I wasn't offered time out. I was given sympathy. I mean, these are caring people and they care, but it was a bit, I always think it was a bit like I'd sprained my ankle. Oh no, that's awful. You're all right. But obviously you can do clinic in the morning, right? Because who else is going to do it?
It's like you've been blooded, mate. Like, like a, it was a rite of passage, maybe some people, a painful, awful one. But yeah, this happens, you have to suck it up. Whereas, of course,
Yes.
some people
And you
can't.
don't, some people can't.
And why should you?
Why should you? You're still that 18-year-old who filled out your UCAS form. You're just a bit older and you've just got a stethoscope. You're the same person. I get messages, still get messages, maybe once a week from senior doctors. And the messages always start the same way. I've never told anyone this, but this will be a hugely experienced GP partner or a professor in an academic hospital department or a consultant, and opening up to a total stranger about tragedies that often happened decades previously that they've not told their families and their partners, and they've not told their friends and not told their colleagues. And I was exactly the same. When my book came out, my family, my friends, they weren't angry, they were sort of distressed that they're finding it whilst reading it in chapter 12 of a book rather than me having told them at the time. My narrative was I've decided to take some time out and see if I can make it as a writer, as a comedian, that sort of thing. But which is half true, but it wasn't the full truth. I was only doing that because I realized that I couldn't keep going on the wards.
It doesn't read to me, that book, like a meditation, as funny as it is, a sort of meditation on grief, on feeling that your life is set and going one way, and then slowly the hope and the optimism in that trajectory being taken from you until there reaches a point. As you say, you apply it as a drip, 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 but as you know, it would have been that moment that you talk about in the labour ward, until it's just not tenable. And you, or while you're talking, and it's just awful. You're just reminded of that sort of now cliche of sort of physician heal thyself. It's like, how can you practice if you are not sort of whole and healthy? And you know, why aren't there the resources available to give basically PTSD treatments to doctors who have to witness? I guess we just think you're superhuman. It's that culture, isn't it, of the doctor.
You want your doctor to be superhuman, yeah, because the person who is operating on your eye, on your leg, on your brain, whatever it is, you want them to be infallible. They need to be some form of God. Because you don't want to even think the possibility, even though you've signed the consent form, you want to think, oh no, not them. They don't make mistakes, because otherwise, how can I think about them, you know, operating on my eye?
And it is. It's like the terms and conditions, isn't it, at the end of an advert, the legal disclaimer. It's presented as something other than the experience you're having. It's like, okay, oh yeah, I'll sign that, whatever. But it's like a waiver, you just... But... as you say, there's no question in that moment where you're about to go under. Your brain won't let you go there to the possibility that this man or woman is not the supreme caretaker.
Absolutely, and there are the sequelae of this, because thinking that your doctor isn't human means they don't just not make mistakes, but they also don't get sick and they don't get sad.
But statistically, they get very sick and sad.
They do. There was a paper out last year in the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, put together by Claire Gerada, who's an amazing doctor, who's one of the main people looking after the mental well-being of medical staff, and said that one doctor takes their life every 3 weeks. It's unimaginable numbers. I was in clinic once, and I was wearing a blood pressure cuff. It was an antenatal clinic. And I was wearing a blood pressure cuff because I just moved house, because you're always moving, because you're always being sent somewhere else. So I'd registered with a GP, and I'd just come off a night shift, and my blood pressure was like 9 billion over 2 billion. And I was like, I've just come off a night shift. Then, no, we do need to check this out. And everything was fine. But anyway, it meant that I was in clinic with this cuff on my arm. And my patient at one point said to me, it's funny, you don't think of your doctor getting ill, do you? No. Mm. And that same clinic would always overrun. And it overran because there was a mismatch between number of patients and number of doctors. Any healthcare professional listening to us nattering now will be well aware. Anyone who's ever been a patient will be well aware that often clinics overrun because lots of patients, not so many staff. And this one was always a bad one. It would overrun 2, maybe 3 hours. That's just what it did. And quite reasonably, at 7 o'clock, when it should have been 5 o'clock, once a week, patients would get antsy and say, my childcare, my car in the parking meter, this and that. Not once did a patient ever say, you probably don't want to be here either, do you? I didn't. I would much rather have been at home. I would have much rather there were an extra 2 obstetric registrars sat elsewhere in the corridor, you know, cracking through the big pile of patients, but those people didn't exist. So
no, you don't think about it. You just don't. I hope I'm always mindful of doctors. I've had a lot to do with them over the years, but actually, that's the one time when you're sat there.
No,
and it's 2 and a half.
Your priority becomes yourself, and quite right. These are the biggest, most stressful moments of your life. And when I was putting this Dear NHS book together, one thing that lots of people said is, I'm not sure I actually said thank you at the time. And doctors don't expect you to, because doctors know that, you know, how stressful it is. But I've kept all the thank you notes that I was ever sent by patients. I'm a decade plus from leaving the profession, and I've thrown away lots of the various gubbins that I collected over the years. But those cards and those notes are things that I will never get rid of because they got me through bad days, weeks, and months. And my hope is that hopefully this collection of thank yous might, in a more abstract way, be a bit of a confidence boost to some people who've had a pretty rubbish few months.
Isn't it strange that having left, you now have this sort of default kind of therapeutic role for practitioners that, you're speaking from the other side, you're pursuing the other half of your passions and ambitions, while they're in that system, but you're able to sort of reach out and go, it's going to be okay, or have you thought about this, or and you've carried
I'm
on
in a very
fighting
lucky
for.
position. I'm extremely fortunate. The success of my books has given me, such as it is, has given me a platform, and it means that I can bang the gong for, particularly for junior doctors, in a way that, no working junior doctor has much of a voice because, I mean, they're working 100 hours a week in hospitals. This book was born from a political place. These were diaries I'd kept and never intended to publish. But you remember 3 or 4 years ago, the junior doctor strikes when
I do.
the government basically imposed a contract that I and a lot of people thought was unfair. And it was unfair because it was going to impact on patient safety, well-being of patients, best interests of patients, which is something that should never be compromised. And the doctors were trying to say this will affect how we care for patients. But the government, for whatever reason, decided their line was going to be the doctors are greedy and they want more money. And the government with their big voice got heard, and the doctors with their quiet voice didn't get heard. And the doctors lost the battle and they lost the war. And it was heartbreaking to see this playing out in real time in front of me, thinking, but this isn't right. This isn't true. Why is no one putting across the other side of the argument? And I thought, if people knew the ins and outs and ups and downs of what it means to be a junior doctor, one random person and the effects on their life, next time round, because there's always a next time, isn't there? It'll be much harder for the public to think that the doctors are in it for the money and they're being greedy. And so I tricked a publisher into publishing these diaries as a book. And here we are, and sort of job done in a way, because now I've got this platform where I can make sure that I can even, I'm so lucky, I can even bend the ear of a politician if I have to. Now, I've been lucky enough to speak to two Secretary of State for Health, one who li didn't listen to me, one who did listen to me. And
I'm
for
presuming the one
all,
who did listen isn't the one who's the current holder of that job title.
the one who listened is the current holder of the job. And I as much as I want to and do criticise what has happened over the last few months, not that I particularly want the job and don't envy anyone, but there have been mistakes made and I've been very vocal about that. I don't criticise someone just because of the colour of the tie they wear. Or it's Matt Hancock said what needs to change about looking after well-being of doctors, and I talked about it. Right when he was at the start of his job, he barely got his feet under the desk, because lots of people on Twitter said, "Oh, you need to read this book." And he was like, "Okay, fine." And he spoke to me right at the start. He didn't really believe what I was saying, I don't think, because it sounded so absurd. There would just be no real useful help available. And then he did his homework. He wasn't expected to know it at the time, but and he was like, "Oh yeah, this is not right." And he put a big chunk of money and resources into looking after the mental well-being of healthcare professionals. And when he announced this money, he name-checked my book. And that is my single proudest moment, because we all know the importance and value of the arts. But it hadn't occurred to me in a million years that something artistic that I might produce could have a tangible effect on policy, which would have an effect on helping doctors, which might even keep people in the profession, maybe, might sort of help their patients. And so I'm so grateful to everyone who's bought my books or listened to me wang on about all this stuff that I do, because it's really, I think I can make more of a difference doing this than in a lifetime of antenatal clinics.
That's really interesting. I mean, we should also put into context the number of weeks that this is going to hurt was number one. Or I think it's, has it only been usurped by your next book? Is that the situation we're in?
I mean, yeah, I think it certainly did more than a year at number one in the Sunday Times, which is absolutely... And it's not because it's the greatest work of literature to ever come across the Sunday Times list. It's because it's got lots of knob jokes in it. And
it's got great knob jokes in it.
It's a confidence trick. It promises that it's going to be funny because it says that on the front. But actually, it's slightly political and sort of a bit of a polemic about what it's like to be on the front line. And the reason it's popular is the same reason that people got on their front steps and banged their pots and pans. And it's the reason that you get angry on Twitter. And it's the reason that you and 108 other people contributed to Dear NHS. It's because of the love we all rightly have for the health service, which I always think is our absolute greatest achievement.
Without question. And also it's a way, it sort of provides a sort of easily digestible marker for who we are as a nation. So it's, if you don't know anything else about us, then you should know this. And that will tell you a lot, that we put our taxes towards medical provision for all free at the point of entry. And, you know, yes, I'm sure, you know, Donald Trump would denounce that as a sort of socialist misadventure, but it's like, you know, it's one of the few things at the moment, as I struggle with what's going on, that still makes me feel this is a great country, because it's a relatively new invention, but it's incredible.
So many people in this Dear NHS book talked about that. Juno Dawson writes a list of her top 10 great things about where we live, and number one is the NHS.
Yeah.
Emma Thompson does such an amazing rallying cry for it. And also there are the people comparing it with America. Stanley Tucci, who's experienced the health service both in the States where he used to live and the UK where he does now. And his bafflement that this is just free. You just get it. You don't have to swipe your credit card on your way in. And Stephen Fry, it's funny you talk about socialized healthcare, which is this, I was promoting This Is Gonna Hurt in the States. And I hadn't really realized until I was over there that free at the point of service healthcare, they've been gaslit to think it's a bad thing.
Mm, yeah.
It is not a bad thing. It's a great thing. And I'm not the only person who is incensed, because Stephen Fry writes about listening to a far-right drone-in on the radio in the States where socialized healthcare was being beaten with a stick as a concept. And he phoned in, and I'd love to hear the audio of
this. Yeah, me too.
And defends socialized healthcare and says, which is an amazing point, that in America, they have a socialized military. You can call, and they love that.
Yeah.
You can call anything socialized if you want to. All that it means is that I'm very lucky and I pay my taxes because I'm lucky enough to earn enough money to pay tax. And there are some people who live near me who aren't lucky enough to pay taxes, and they get it paid for them. And I, as a doctor, never ask someone if they can afford it. And hopefully no UK doctor ever will. I've been a patient in the States, and it's a very different experience.
Awful. It's awful. I mean, My niece, who's very sort of pretty wee, she suffers from migraines really terribly, and she collapsed in New York on a school trip. And they ran her through MRI machines over a 24-hour period, and the bill was $80,000. She did one night stay,
Oh,
eighty.
my
And even though
word.
she was insured, they still managed to present this bill to my brother, who thankfully, unlike me, does not suffer from extreme anxiety. So he was able to calmly go, "Well, I'm not going to have to pay this because I've paid the insurance." But it just, I mean, I think of all the people, who've made a lot of documentaries in the States, who I'm always fixated on learning how much they pay per month. I mean, really broke working class families paying $1,500 a month for medical care, just driving them into the ground. But it's such a good point that everything, our police force is socialised. Anything that comes out of the public taxation pot is a socialised.
It's socialized. Americans are polled every year by Gallup about what's their single greatest concern. And every year for the last half a decade, the biggest concern amongst the American public is the availability and the affordability of healthcare. Anyone listening to us in the UK, I hope none of them have that anywhere on their list of concerns. It shouldn't be, it can't be, because it's there. It's like it was founded to do 72 years ago. It's free at the point of service, based on your clinical need, not based on your bank balance. I've been a patient in the States, thankfully, for a very minor thing. And a doctor has said to me, I'd got some glass basically in a joint, just above my knuckle. I can show you on Zoom, just on that. There's a bit of a
Can
big,
you
bit of a bit on my knuckle there. Yeah. So
that scar
just a,
tissue, or
it
is it
was a
still in
minor injury,
there?
but that's just scar tissue. But it just would not stop bleeding. I mean, I've told this story before. It's one of my favorite dinner party stories. I think we were on holiday in Miami, which I love. And James, my husband, was out at the pool, and I went to the loo, and I sat down on the loo, and I felt something in my hair, and it was like it's something. Yeah, it felt like a fly or something. So I just brushed my hand into my hair. It wasn't a fly. A bit of glass had fallen out of a picture frame behind me when I sat down into my hair, and a bit of glass went in my finger. And I took it out, and it hit some little blood vessel, which went pss, pss, pss,
Oh.
pss. The more I pressed it, the more it just spurted out between my other fingers while I was pressing it. And I came back from the loo, covered in blood, and I mean, comically covered in blood. And people were screaming. James wasn't screaming as much as the other people, but. Now I think about it. Anyway, and the hotel were great, and they were trying to stop it and put tourniquets on my. It was not stopping bleeding. So with some embarrassment, we ended up going to the nearest emergency department, where the first question was, "How are we paying for this, sir?" "Well, with my travel insurance." "Okay, can I have the policy number?" "No, of course you can't, because I'm bleeding and I don't know where it is, and maybe I never even got it. Who knows?" And so I gave them my card, and the doctor asked me the question. Normally, we would X-ray a joint if there's any chance of there's any glass in it, but it will be an extra $1,500 or whatever it was. And I, on one hand, had my doctor, vague vestiges of doctor knowledge, telling me, "You definitely X-ray the hand that's the joint that's got a potential glass injury." On the other hand, I was thinking, I mean, if it's $1,500 and the exchange rate isn't great, and what if I didn't get the travel insurance? I was what really weighing it up before James, being the sensible one, was like, obviously, if you need it, you need it. Life goes on. $1,500, fine. But it's a very weird position to be in as a patient. you want your medical care to be based on best practice, not best practice plus the financial risk.
Yes, and how can a patient who doesn't have years of medical expertise cherry pick the treatments according to how much money they've got left? So going, oh God, I've got enough for the MRI, but I don't have enough for the ultrasound.
Very dangerous.
CT. I mean, yeah, because essentially you're then going to make your own clinical decisions based on price.
And that is why two-tier systems are bad, because the people who suffer the most are the people who have the least, and the people who have the least always have the quietest voice.
Well, no, and it's also this worrying trend towards personal responsibility as opposed to state protection. And of course, there is a line to be drawn somewhere between those two things. One does have to have personal agency. You do need to try and be the best person you can be and take care of yourself in the best way you can. But the state is, that is the reason that we give them our money, so that they, through a system of sort of, you know, through connections and intelligence and, you know, opinion sourcing, can provide the best overall care for us. And yeah. I would rather a nanny state than anybody turn up to a hospital and be told that their own behaviour precludes them from getting treatment.
Absolutely. And I would love a nanny state at the moment. I just think we need a slightly better nanny.
Yeah, I'd like to change nanny, but we're away off that. Yeah. Just a sort of benign nanny McPhee that'll tuck us up and make us feel reassured so I don't have the nightmares anymore.
A nanny who prevents us dying from infectious diseases sweeping through the nation.
A nanny who says, let's put the face masks on now, not just pick an arbitrary date and sort of say 10 days time to pop them on.
Yeah. Because unless you've told every single molecule of virus about this cutoff date, I don't think it's going to work.
And maybe a nanny who makes sure that before they tell you what to do, they've made sure all the other nannies do it first as a way of showing the way.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good
point.
That
way I'd sleep at night as opposed to my current state, which is 2 hours, wake up, panic, back 2 hours, wake up, because it feels like we're at the end of the world. But then I think about your journey and I think about how much you can change by being truthful. And just by telling your truth, and how the most inauthentic of kind of sort of saber rattlers are the ones that just do it because they want the posture or the tag or whatever. But it's the ones that do it because they've lived it. Those are the ones that you listen to. And as you say, your book, which is fun and painful and deservedly best-selling a million times over, you know, it's made a difference in policy. It's brought you to where you needed to be as a writer, but it's also substantially transformed the lives and the landscape of, you know, of those working in the medical profession.
I mean, I should say I am one of thousands of people who are banging the same gong. I can't take too much responsibility, but I'm one of the lucky ones who BBC Breakfast will have on.
Surely it's got to be a slight. That's early. I mean, that's heroic in itself. The fact you've
been
with BBC Breakfast
with locked. Down, it's a lot less painful.
Tell me what, I mean, we've spoken about you writing and how critical that is to your own well-being and your sort of almost recovery from being a medic into this brave new future. Would you stay sort of focused and discussing things of a medical nature, or do you have plans for a completely different next project?
I've learnt from the 40 years I've had so far now not to look too far ahead, because I will definitely be wrong with my predictions. But I know what my next book is because I've just handed it in. Mm-hmm. And that, thank you very much.
Bloody hell, that's a thing in itself.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who hasn't written a book, which is probably most people listening, won't know that the feeling of extreme relief when you don't have to change the book anymore, because there's a lot of rewriting. It's a bit of a process. This feels like a very sort of Prosecco problem moan, doesn't it? But anyway, but this is a kid's book called Kay's Anatomy, which is a good title because none of the 8 to 12-year-olds who receive the book will get the pun.
Perfect target audience. For your noughties medical drama related.
Yeah, exactly. And it is hopefully a funny slash disgusting medical textbook. Because I've always been obsessed with the body and the interesting ways it can go wrong and the way it all works. And for whatever reason, it's never been a cool topic for kids. It's never been dinosaurs, and it's never been the Tudors, and it's never been space. No. Maybe it's because you're forced to learn it too much in biology. Well, for whatever reason. But so this is my attempt to A, teach kids all about the body, and B, teach their parents who probably never actually worked it out at school. And by reading along with their kids, they will secretly learn what the spleen does.
I'm not sure I know what the spleen does.
Do you know where it is?
I think it's near your liver.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, when I say near, I mean, that was pretty loose, wasn't it?
I mean, that yeah,
it's
sort of...
Everything's fairly... Liver's enormous. Yeah.
Liver's top right abdomen.
Does the spleen do bile?
Spleen's top left.
Was that the gallbladder?
Bile, that's gallbladder.
Okay.
That the bile duct, and that plays with the liver. So
what does the spleen do? I know that lots of people, but it's often the thing that gets damaged or removed in accidents.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But was it the spleen that caused the accidents? No. So
I was going to say that's a powerful spleen. If it's sort of forcing you off the road into a wall. What does it do?
It filters your blood.
Oh, okay.
Because your blood cells don't live forever, RIP. Each red blood cell's only got a few months in it. Luckily,
spoiler alert.
Yeah, so yeah, luckily you make blood cells. Do you know where you make your blood cells?
I'm going to say in your bone marrow.
Yeah.
Did
10
I get it
points,
right?
Perkins. Yeah. But when they've got a bit knackered, they go through your spleen, which gets rid of it's like a filter, basically, gets rid of the manky ones, allows the working ones through. And then if they're manky ones, they're a type of white blood cell who live there called macrophages, which means big eater.
You
and
the
big
it,
eater cell eat the old red blood cells. So,
it's like a sort
example,
of Pac-Man just munching up the old dead stuff.
Exactly that. So anyway.
I'm going to read your book because I have, I believe, the same medical knowledge as a sort of 7 or 8 year old. So I will learn stuff.
Oh, but target
also,
audience.
But you, yes, keen middle-aged women who sort of bypassed any form of sort of scientific knowledge and learning. But the great thing is because there is a tendency for kids' books to focus on the sort of on bodily fluids, you've always got that angle as well. You can do pus, you can do poo, you can
there
do
are a lot of fluids
puke.
And all this stuff is interesting. It all has a function, like the fact that your poo is alive.
That would be ridiculous. Of course it isn't alive,
because it has more, the majority of cells in your poo are bacteria.
How long before they die? How long before a poo is dead? Asking for a friend. But
very soon. By the time you've flushed, you have nothing to worry about. There's a lot of creepy stuff, like the fact that your outermost layer isn't your skin. It's this creepy cloud of dead cells.
What? We've got like a sort of weird dust halo around us.
Yes, and not just dust. Anything that comes out of any of your orifices, there's sort of poo flecks and everything, and sort of mucus and everything. When people think they can see someone's aura, maybe that's what they're seeing.
Right. Sort of the corona of poo that goes around. Like, is it Linus in the Peanuts cartoon? Is that we're all like that? We're all Linus.
Yeah.
Linus was unwittingly bullied, but basically merely showing the poo corona that the rest of us have. Poor Linus. What I do want to know, now we're on this subject, is it true if you can smell poo, you're essentially eating it, because it means that the poo spores, not a technical term, are in the air?
Yes, I mean, that's what...
There was a pause there, and I can't buy that.
Smelling stuff is. I mean, it's...
To smell it,
I mean,
it has to be
particles.
Bits of it present.
Yes. There's, yeah, that's exactly right. Particles of poo wherever you sniff.
Oh God, I don't. Oh dear, I don't. That's why I've never understood why people clean their teeth while their partner's doing a dump. I can't get on board with that.
Oh no, oh God. I mean, and in fact, you should never even take your phone into the toilet, because if you swab the screen of a phone after a poo, you might as well have, swirled it round in the
In the basin, in the bowl.
in the bowl, yeah.
Oh my God, I wish we'd started with this. I've got so many supplementary questions. But you know what? That's all. It's all good because I can read the book and get my answers. Thank you for spending some time with me, and I'm glad you spent lockdown sort of constructively writing your next book. Whereas the rest of us just know how to
Thank you for
say
having me.
yellow flowers in Spanish. That's it. That's
Oh,
all I know. I will see you on the other side of this strange mess that we're in.
looking forward to raising a glass of, what am I drinking now? Dash water in real life.
Adam's book, Dear NHS, is available to buy now from all good bookstores. And his children's book, Kay's Anatomy, will be out in October. You can pre-order signed copies now from Waterstones. As always, all the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith. You can check out all his music on Spotify.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue, all I do is stare at you. I'll be heading east to find my peace where the desert feasts.